you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Charlie Robinson on the show. Charlie is the author of The Octopus of Global Control. Charlie, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm loving your work. I'm into it for sure. This is a very good fit, I think.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Well, talk about this, but first let's let you introduce yourself to my audience.
Sure. I never set out to be an author, to be honest with you. I was in real estate, but I was living in Las Vegas, selling real estate, going through the hottest real estate market in the world. Well, maybe second only to Dubai at the time. And I was heading out to on a vacation, and a buddy of mine said, "Hey, I got a book. You should read this while you're gone." And it was Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. Mm-hmm. And I'd never heard of it before. I read the whole thing during the trip. It was a scuba diving trip, and I remember being so into the book that while I was underwater, I was thinking, wow, when I come up, I'll be able to read another chapter. You know, that's how engaging the book was to me. And so, you know, so, and for those that haven't read the book, I highly recommend it, by the way, obviously. But what it does is John Perkins lays out this, he used to be what they called an economic hitman. He worked for a multinational engineering company, something like a Halliburton back in the 60s and 70s. And what they would,
Chase T. Maine, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they would approach third world countries, Ecuador and, you know, as an example, Ecuador. And they would say to them, you know, you've got the setup here for a great hydroelectric power plant. If we were to build one here, it would generate electricity. It would generate a ton of revenue. It would pay for itself in a couple of years. Your family, the villages nearby would have electricity. Your kids would learn to read at night from, you know, because of the electricity and all these great things, all these benefits. They would sell them on this. They would sell the president on it. And of course, they'd say, well, you know, don't worry about money. We've got that arranged by the World Bank and the IMF. They'd agree. They'd set up this big loan that would go directly from the IMF and World Bank to the multinational engineering firm. In his case, it was Maine. Today, it would be Halliburton, Bechtel, or one of those companies. And then they would start on this project that was never going to pencil out. It was never going to work. It was intentional that it wasn't going to work. So it gets built, starts to generate some money, but not enough to cover the costs. And sooner or later, they fall behind on their payments. And like a loan shark, they then approach the country and say, you owe us a lot of money. You're not paying it. but I think we can work out a deal. How about you allow us to privatize your lumber industry or put a military base there or vote our way in a UN resolution, something that definitely benefits the empire and not the country. And so he would do that. He would go to these countries and arrange these deals. And he saw what it was doing. It was enslaving them. It was just a gigantic debt trap to capture these countries and then put them under the control of the World Bank, which was essentially under the control of the bankers, which was under the control of the American Empire in some way, shape, or form. It was tied into them. So I'm reading this. I'm reading this book on my trip, and I'm understanding how they extend debt to countries that can't afford it and then get them into a bind and then screw them and take back tangible assets like fishing industries, lumber industries, or something like that. And so as I'm reading this, then I'm in Las Vegas, and this is 2007, early 2007. I'm watching the market. We've expanded the credit to people that have no business buying houses, but the banks are like, yeah, you want a mortgage? We can get you a mortgage. No money down even. It's great. You make $8 an hour? No problem. Don't worry. Look, this is how it'll work. It'll be fine. And so I'm going, oh my God, they're doing this exact same scam on a lower, on a central, you know, like a smaller level, centralized level in Las Vegas. And then the bubble pops, as it would, and the banks start to take back tangible assets. So they've loaned out all these imaginary dollars, these dollars that they've borrowed from the Federal Reserve, you know, that have just been created and loaned into existence, as they say. And then the people are defaulting on them because there was no way they couldn't default on them. And then the banks were taking back houses. And I was like, this is just that exact same scam. So, and then I felt like I was complicit in it in some way because I was the person that was selling the houses, but I didn't know. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand the game. So I did, though, at that time, I did understand that 9/11 was not what we were told. So I wasn't that naive, but I didn't realize the banking component of it. And so that was when my eyes, you know, that was when I woke up to the reality of what we're seeing. And from that point on, I have been, you know, I had just been sort of an amateur, you know, just an amateur with an interest in this sort of in all these sort of I don't know, I guess you'd call them conspiracies, but they're not to be confused with imaginary conspiracies. I mean, these were real conspiracies that were happening. And as I started to dig into one, it led me to another, and down the rabbit hole you go. So a couple years go by, and I had a conversation with my dear old mother, and I was telling her about some new conspiracy. I just learned about how interesting and fascinating it was. And she was, you know, she's like, cool, this is interesting. You found all of this information. You've done all this research, you know, about all these different things. What are you going to do about it? And I was like, I don't know. I didn't know I had to do anything about it. It never crossed my mind that I actually had I was a participant in this, that I had a role in it. So after that conversation, I sort of tried to think about what I would do. Like in your case, you have a great podcast. You know, people are finding out about it through, you know, online. For me, I just decided I think I could write a book. I think I could compile this information. I've been writing it in my head essentially for years. I'll put it together, but I'm going to do it in a way that brings in the voices of all the people that have had a hand, not all the people, but many people that had a hand in these important events throughout world history. So the book has quotes from over 500 different people, Rockefellers and Rothschilds and Clintons and Bushes and all those maniacs that you would expect to be in there, but also George Carlin, Bill Hicks, Joe Rogan, comedians, people that have a different view of it, people that can point out the hypocrisy in the whole structure of this thing. And so because I thought it was interesting when I would hear, like when you hear that David Rockefeller in his autobiography talks about how he's been accused of being an internationalist, that he is setting out to form a one world government. And then he says, if that's the charges, I stand proud. And I agree, that is what I'm out to do. And you're like, oh my God, I can't believe he actually said it. I had always thought this was a rumor, but here it is in his autobiography. Unless he got misquoted, like Charles Barkley, we ought to listen to what he's got to say. It's on page 405. He's talking about, you know, if this is the charge, I stand guilty of it. I'm like, holy crap. So you're never going to hear that on the news. But if you're trying to talk to people about a new world order, a one world government, people tend to just kind of roll their eyes. But it's like, hey, would it make a difference if you heard that David Rockefeller in his autobiography said that he is putting together a one world government, a new world order? Would that change your mind? And a lot of people will say, well, yeah, I guess it would change my mind if I heard it from, well, here it is. And so that was part of my thinking, was that it was more than just, this is my opinion on what's going on. It was, this is what these people are saying, that you're not going to hear on the nightly news. You're not going to read it in Time magazine because they control these channels of information, but here it is. And as an example, the concept of the octopus is not mine. It's been around for a long time. Danny Casolaro got himself killed talking about the octopus.
But
I'll read a quote, and this is what got me. This is probably one of the most important quotes in the book. The real menace of our republic is the invisible government, which like a giant octopus sprawls its slimy legs over our cities, states, and nation. To depart from mere generalizations, let me say that at the head of this octopus are the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests and a small group of powerful banking houses, generally referred to as the international bankers. The little coterie of powerful international bankers virtually run the United States government for their own selfish purposes. They practically control both parties, write political platforms, make cat's paw of party leaders, use the leading men of private organizations, and resort to every device to place in nomination for high public office only such candidates as will be amenable to the dictates of corrupt big business. These international bankers and Rockefeller Standard Oil interests control the majority of the newspapers and magazines in this country. They use the columns of these papers to club into submission or drive out of office public officials who refuse to do the bidding of the powerful corrupt cliques which compose the invisible government. It operates under cover of a self-created screen and seizes our executive officers, legislative bodies, schools, courts, newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection. So that is a quote from John Francis Hyland, the mayor of New York City. But that's from 1922. We're talking about 100 years ago, just about. And nothing has changed. And when I read that, I thought, well, that's the best description I've ever heard of what's going on. And there is an octopus. And the octopus is a perfect symbol for this because it's a everybody knows it changes colors. You know, everybody knows it's very deceptive. It changes textures. It's extremely smart. It's terrifying. It's vicious, too. It has a beak that nobody sees, so it's got a hidden beak. It'll spray ink and disappear, or it'll stay and fight. It's the perfect metaphor for what's going on here. Yes, that is what we've come up against. And so for me, I labeled the eight tentacles as being military control, governmental control, covert control, physical, financial, media, spiritual, and scientific. And through those eight tentacles, they have got a stranglehold on us. And the problem, I think a lot of us have noticed, and most of us are kind of, anyone who's listening to this is either awake or in some state of waking up. But the vast majority of people don't even know that there are forces working against them. They're just sort of going about their daily life on autopilot, like we all have done, like I've done. And they don't even know that their own government is actively working against them. And so that is that's something that I came to the realization of. And once you understand that, once you know that, once you can never unknow it. You know, it's always with you. It's something that you just can't shake. And so if you turn on the nightly news, you're reminded of the lies every single time you watch the news. I mean, it's right in our face. And so, you know, that's in a nutshell, that's sort of how it came about. And that's the core of what the book is about.
What personal expense? What personal expense? You wrote the book in secret without your family knowing about it?
Yeah, I wrote the book. I wrote the book.
And you're married, right? Now, that's tough to do.
It
it's
is
like having an affair, you know.
I've got a story for you. I wrote it in secret. I didn't tell anyone, in part because
you didn't check any motels, right? Did you?
No. No. I didn't. It wasn't any of that. Okay. I didn't know if I would finish it, to be honest with you. I didn't know if it was going to be something that I started and didn't finish. And so I didn't want to be on the hook with friends and family and say, oh, I'm going to write this book. And then they go, hey, man, how's that book coming? And they're like, oh, I never finished it. So part of it was that. And I decided I would write it until it didn't – if it didn't feel good, I would stop. But I kept writing it and felt better. But I didn't – I also just didn't want to tell anyone about it. So as it came out, once it was finished and the first – shipment of the hard copy books arrived, I was not home to get the box, and my wife was. And she opened the box, saw the book, saw me on the back of it, and called me and told me not to come home. So I got thrown out of the house for a couple days. That's a true story, honest to God. And I was like, honey, I didn't have an affair. I don't have a secret double life. I don't have another family somewhere. You know, look, I wrote a book. How bad, you know? She was not impressed and not accepting that excuse. She's softened her stance a bit lately, but still early on it was essentially like getting caught cheating, but it was like cheating with my laptop, essentially.
So. I guess she considered it an emotional infidelity.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah. But it was one of those, well, if I told you I was writing it, would you let me write it? No, probably she would have had a problem with it. So I kind of had to do it. I didn't, like I said, I wasn't sure if I'd ever finish it. So it was one of those no harm, no foul. But once it got done and once it got out there, then it became impossible to hide from. So, yeah.
Well, generally speaking, my experience is this is generally a feminine trait that women have, is that they look at such endeavors and research sort of as a threat because it upsets the domesticity, the nesting.
So they see
it as not being very productive or helpful to the family, and so they'll
correct,
you know, and so it just, you know, so that, you know, it's too abstract. I mean, obviously there are plenty of women that do get into this research, but let's face it, it's male dominated, and that's there's a reason for that. But that's funny. Yeah, but she was
she was not there. And it's hard to say, well, listen, I got into the conspiracy industry for the money,
you know,
because we know there's no money in that. So,
well, I mean, yeah, you look into these things and I think, obviously, I suspect you probably have had a few holiday dinners, Thanksgiving, Christmas, barbecues disrupted by this stuff. And I've had a similar experience. It's usually
book came out of that. I came out of a busted Thanksgiving dinner. No doubt about it.
Yeah. But my experience is it's usually, I don't bring it up.
I don't anymore.
You know,
but my thinking was though, if it was one of those things where it was a Thanksgiving dinner where we got on the topic of 9/11 and I had some of my facts, but there wasn't a real organized argument and I didn't have the ability to, you know, I couldn't bring out flow charts and videos and anything like that.
Well,
you know,
came so to I have was dinner, sort of, right? You come to
I came to have, I came to have dinner and I didn't have my notes with me. And so I got destroyed. And the problem is, so I thought, well, and, you know,
let me guess, you had 10 different people talking to you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep. It was, and it was like, but part of it was if you could hear the structural engineers talk about 9/11, it would make more sense. Like, I'm not a structural engineer. Would you believe it if Richard Gage said it? Would you, somebody that has experience, would it make sense if he could explain to you how, you know, jet fuel can't melt steel and it's a mathematical, it's an engineering impossibility that those buildings could have come down like that. And, you know, and so when I was thinking that if I wrote this book, not that somebody's going to take it with them to the Thanksgiving dinner table, but it would give them somebody ammunition. It would give somebody the ability to say, listen, you think I'm crazy and that's fine. Read this book. This book is not, it's not, you know, it brings in the voices of all these different experts that have that lend their expertise to it so that it's not even about me or the reader or whoever you can give it to somebody that's on the fence or that doesn't get this, you know, that doesn't understand this, this world. You can hand it to them and say, just pick any chapter any topic and just read a little bit about it, and it'll fill in the blanks, because the people that you respect, some of the people whose voices that you Thomas Jefferson, if you hear Thomas Jefferson talking about the Federal Reserve or central banking, I mean, and talking about how crooked they are, maybe that would make a difference. Or like I said, if you heard David Rockefeller say in his autobiography he wants a one world government, you know, maybe that would help to get them to say, maybe there is a little something to this. So it's almost a – some people say it was sort of the encyclopedia of conspiracy theories, mm-hmm. which I don't disagree with. But it's a great book for people to give to other people in their lives that they're trying to wake up, because it just brings in so many different voices, and not always good ones either, by the way. You know, Richard Nixon and Kissinger and George H.W. Bush, who, you know, just died. So you know,
how many times did George H.W. Bush refer to a New World Order?
I mean, I lost track. I think I only put like 7 different times in which he referred to it, but I think I could have put at least 100 of them in there. Mm-hmm. But it's ongoing. It's not just him. It's Richard Nixon. Each of us has the hope to build a new world order, Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. You've got J. Edgar Hoover talking about, you've got Kissinger, the new world order cannot happen without U.S. participation, as we are the single most significant component. Yes, there will be a new world order, and it will force the United States to change its perceptions. So all these things are on record. So you keep having these people over and over again talking about it. And, you know, appropriately for where we are right now, you get the nightly news, and all you see over the last week is one gushing story about George H.W. Yeah. Bush after another, and it just makes you sick. You just want to scream, like, do you even know who this guy is? You wouldn't be marching him from funeral to funeral to train if you knew who this guy was? Would it make a difference if you knew that he was on the record saying, if the American people find out what we've done, they would chase us down the street and lynch us? Like, does that matter? I didn't hear that on CNN. I didn't hear them talking about any of his cocaine trafficking. I didn't hear him talking about the Franklin scandal. I didn't hear them talking about the Naraya, the Kuwaiti girl that said they took the babies out of the incubators and left them to die on the cold floor. I mean, that was a 100% fabrication. She was the daughter of the U.S. ambassador to Kuwait, mm-hmm. and the Kuwaiti ambassador to the U.S. I'm not sure which one it was, but who was coached by Hill and Knowlton. This all come out as being, you know, that was a lie. It's not
Hill and
me.
Knowlton is this PR firm, which is
right.
I think Robert Gray, who was also compromised. He was a homosexual. He was sexually compromised, and it involves his national security director, who got caught up in the Franklin scandal and these things. He was also the ambassador to South Korea.
Yep. There's a lot of that. And so like, you know, these things, the news sort of passes over, they gloss over, they don't even mention it in half of this stuff, but it's like, you know, George H.W. Bush lied us into a war that killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and later his son finished the job by lying us into two more wars. And the news, you know, if you're looking at the news, if you're looking at the mainstream news as your source of information, you're going to be at a severe disadvantage for understanding what's really going on. It's just one very warped version of the world.
Yeah, and also no one mentions his strange connections to the Kennedy assassination, which
he's the only person in the world that doesn't, in the country that was alive, that doesn't remember where they were when John Kennedy was assassinated. He also happened to, his son was supposed to have dinner with the Hinckleys the night before Reagan was shot.
One of the Bush business partners shot the president. Yeah.
Right. And he was having a business a meeting on the morning of September 11th in Washington, D.C. with the Bin Laden family on behalf of the Carlyle Group. Mm-hmm. So he's been quite a few coincidences surrounding that guy. And yet he's the wimp. He's the wimp. I don't want to eat my broccoli. I'm the president. I don't have to eat it. You know, and all that nonsense. And like, people don't even stop to realize that.
Well, it's not just the news. It's also like comedy, where how he's portrayed in comedy, you know, Dana Carvey.
Right.
In these things. And so this builds this, and he loves that. I mean, I think Bush loved that, the fact he was portrayed as a wimp or kind of a harmless nerd transplant to Texas and these things, and give him cover. Yeah. And if you want to know, I guess, who is it? Damagard, Ole Damagard.
Yes. Yes.
And he interviews, who's that guy, that pilot, CIA hitman?
That he interviewed. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, he, the hitman?
Yeah,
we're talking about?
Well, the guy does Black Ops, who wouldn't carry out missions in the U.S. So he got, he claims that Bush was the most evil man he ever met.
He's Kathy O'Brien as well. She's got some stories about him. It's been well documented in the alternative media who this guy really was. And, it's a shame to turn on the news and just see all these people lining up for his funeral and crying and all these things. And you just shake your head and you go, if you only knew, but I think a lot of people don't want to know.
No, because it unveils something. The underworld that really controls things, and the political underworld that ties into the literal underworld, but it's the same thing, because to acknowledge that reality, you have to pretty much acknowledge the entire thing, and that's just too unpleasant. And yeah. So people just have no understanding. I've to this day, I still hear people talking about conventional, electoral politics, or talking about, I'll be at a gathering, they're talking about, whatever the news is at the time, and there's still no recognition of this deep, dark, this very disturbing underworld, which really controls the political process and the world economy in our lives. They don't understand the psychological warfare that they themselves are being subjected to in their children.
I describe it in the book as like, growing up believing in Santa Claus and then realizing that Santa Claus was the Night Stalker all along. You just don't want to know it, slipping into your house undetected and doing who knows what while you're asleep. A lot of people just say, I want Santa. I don't want the Night Stalker.
Well, I can understand that too. I tell people, when I start talking about a few of these things, and it gets, I can tell that I'm talking about a different world. And I said, well, listen, if you've about 5 years, I can recommend about 50 books to you, and then get back to me.
Right.
Because I don't, at this point, you don't have the patience or the inclination to listen. I'm just wasting my breath. If I hit my head against a brick wall, I get a headache. What's the point? And I'm at that point now. I don't no longer suffer fools anymore. And I get direct questions about something, and I'll name a figure. The way I explain something is I sometimes point out a figure and say, research his career. The other day, over Thanksgiving Day weekend, we were talking, my brother's son, who's a teenager, made an offhand remark about how drugs should be legalized. And so then his uncle started picking on him. And I said, well, the drug war is a fraud. I'm not endorsing drug use, but the drug war is a fraud. The biggest, facilitator of drug importation in the United States is the CIA, and that's documented. Like, what are you talking about? I said, look up if you want to know what I'm talking about, just look up the career of Paul Helliwell. Just focus on him and study his career. He was a banker lawyer working with Meyer Lansky, who set up the Nugenhan Bank, the Castle Bank in the Bahamas. Paradise, the resort down there, Resorts International, was a successor is a successor to Mary Carter Paint Company that was set up with the CIA and Meyer Lansky to facilitate the importation of drugs in the United States and launder money. And the drugs are so integrated in the U.S. economy, we have a sitting president who owned Resorts International, who ties right back to Meyer Lansky. Just look it up. He's like, I don't need to look at it. Well, that's how you understand these. There's no way I can really shorten it for you in a way. Just focus on that, and then you might have an understanding that the whole thing's a fraud.
They're making movies, American made, with Tom Cruise, where he's flying in cocaine for the CIA. They're not even hiding it anymore. It's like they don't call it the Cocaine Importation Agency for nothing. There's documented, there's CIA planes that have crashed with hundreds of kilos of cocaine. it's like they're sloppy at this point, because I don't think they even really, they've been doing it for so long. Like anything, you do it for so long, you just sort of are on autopilot, maybe literally on autopilot with those airplanes. And they just don't really, they've gotten a bit sloppy over the years. It's become common knowledge for people like us. But, but the first time you hear that, get out of here.
Well, I can empathize, because I remember, 15, 20 years ago, I came across it rather gradually. So it's kind of a... it wasn't like, oh, you know, then there was 9/11 and these things. But after when 9/11 occurred, I was already aware of Operation Northwoods and the problems with the Kennedy assassination, the official narrative. So I had a certain context that I could understand it. If you're aware of Gladio, Operation Gladio in Europe, and all of a sudden you hear about the potential false flag events here in the United States, staged events, you're like, well, yeah, it's feasible because they've done it before.
Yeah, I was on 9/11 though. I was not aware of those things. I was still blissfully ignorant to those operations. And so as as 9/11 happens, and you go, well, I mean, I did see it on TV, and I suppose it could have happened. I don't know what it looks like when a building comes down. I don't know what it looks like when a plane that big crashes into a building. So they came down. Sure, I guess that's possible because I'm not a structural engineer and I don't know the ins and outs of it. But when you see Building 7 come down, then you go, you know, I'm still not a structural engineer, but I'm not sure that I need to be one to understand that that was a symmetrical implosion. And if that building was rigged, then the other buildings were rigged. And so then if that's a lie, what else is a lie? And that was kind of where I was going with the book as well, is that there's 50 different topics in there, and some will be more relevant to people than others, you know, and some people might have had a relative that fought in Vietnam. And as far as they know, it was to stop the spread of communism. It was kicked off by the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And then you read that the Gulf of Tonkin incident wasn't an incident at all. It never happened. It was a non-event, and that it was but that was why we got into Vietnam. And so for somebody, it might be like, hey, you know, my brother was in Vietnam and he died in Vietnam and I didn't know anything about that. And if that's a lie, what else is a lie? So that sort of starts the chain reaction of digging into, you know, from one event to the other. So, you know, it might be that some of the topics in the books don't appeal to people. Not all of them do, but there will be a couple for sure that do. And then once you get into that and you get a real deep understanding of, okay, that event that we were told did not happen the way we were told it happened, or if it even happened at all. And so you start to build a little bit of distrust, and then you start to see similarities, things that are like, oh, you hear about Operation Gladio. Oh, okay, well, Gladio is happening in Europe. Doesn't Gladio sound a whole lot like what's happening here? Yeah, it does. But they wouldn't lie to us about that, would they? Well, the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act of 2012 legalized propaganda in the United States. Did you know that? And people go, what's the Smith-Mundt Act? And you go, well, that was put in years ago that made it illegal for there to be propaganda in the United States. And in 2012, Obama signed into law the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act, which made propaganda legal. And you say, well, was it expiring and they needed to do a new one? No, wasn't expiring. They could have done nothing. It would have stayed in place. But they actively went out and changed that law to legalize propaganda. Although I think a lot of people would say propaganda has been going on before. I don't know why they felt the need to actually legalize it.
Suggest an escalation or coming out. Yeah.
Right. So, but then you go, well, after that, after that happened, after that was kicked into effect, then you start to see a rash of false flag shootings going on in this country. And you go, well, that's interesting. Maybe those things are tied together. Yeah, they are tied together. There's so it becomes sort of this chain reaction in people's minds where one thing leads to another, then you have to backtrack and you have to go, oh God, well, let me check out World War II. You know, what was that all about? Was that real? Was it what we told? Well, you know, here we just a couple days ago passed the Pearl Harbor anniversary.
Yeah.
Was that real? Well, there's not necessarily. You know, there was definitely foreknowledge of that happening. Oh, geez, really? Well, then that starts you thinking, you know, starts you looking into World War II. And before long, you're writing a book in the middle of the night without your wife knowing about it.
Yeah, it's one of these. It's so disorienting to many people that they lose their critical faculty shut down. And they, I think you've pointed out in another interview, is the sort of one of the incidents was the San Bernardino shooting, where you have this odd story of a husband and wife team with a small child, but they're crazy Muslims. So, okay. Americans go, it must be because they're crazy Muslims. Right.
Right.
But then they have this weird thing where, okay, so they both end up dying. They're both dead. Mm-hmm. So dead men tell no tales, but they have this weird, when the media is able to go into the apartment and, yeah. and go through a crime scene and start touching things.
Yeah.
That's not normal.
No, it wasn't normal. There was like a video in the house of all these other media members all in the yeah. house at the same time going through looking for things. And they're like, hey, I found this manifesto here. What's funny about that is that the minute it I was at home and my mother happened to be over for some reason. And I just turned the TV on and the shooting and it's like breaking news. San Bernardino yeah. shooting. Now we're from Southern California originally. So like San Bernardino is a place we're very familiar with. So as soon as it comes on, I turn the volume down. I say to my mom, I don't know anything about this. You don't know anything about this. It just happened. I'm going to tell you five things that are going to happen in this thing. And if I am right, either I'm psychic, which I'm not, or I understand the narrative. And, you know, it was like, they're going to be dead for sure. They'll leave a manifesto for sure. They'll tear apart the crime scene, but totally compromise it, which of course they did. They'll blame it on Muslims, and there will be a report of white or non-Muslim actual shooters, and that's mm-hmm. exactly what all of those things happened. And so, you know, it's funny that the sheriff said that their apartment was a veritable bomb manufacturing facility. And my thinking was, well, then why'd you let the media in there unless you were hoping that they would all blow themselves up, which I'm sure was totally possible that the sheriff was thinking, well, you know, the worst things could have happened than the media. All
if I recall, the media, they had like Christmas gifts out or something. And
it was nuts. Yeah. It was like if you made a list of things to not do with a crime scene, they did all of them.
Well, they,
you
know, that's the funny thing is if it is indeed a crime scene, then all those media figures were breaking the law, which leads yeah. them to believe legally it probably wasn't a crime scene because.
No.
You see? And
reports. You've got people that like a lady that was in that building who is called 911 and saying there are three men,
yeah,
three white men, well-built white men in military fatigues that are shooting up this place. Nobody heard. Well, I didn't hear about that on the nightly news. Why? Because it didn't fit with the narrative. The narrative of crazy Muslims in this country liable to do anything. And the Muslims aren't a problem in this country. They're not as they're no more of a problem in this country than anybody else that's disgruntled. But you know, I'll tell you what, you demonize these people long enough and they're going to be a problem, you know, and you can't really blame them at this point. It's like when George Bush said a couple days after 9/11, you know, they hate us for our freedoms. They don't hate us for our freedoms. They hate us because we're in their country bombing them and killing their children. In fact, they didn't. I felt like, you know, in the book, I said, don't flatter yourself. They don't care about our freedoms. They've got their own problems. You think somebody in Iraq or Afghanistan gives a damn about the freedoms of the United States? They're just struggling to survive and keep their family. Much like I don't worry about the freedoms of Afghanistan. Maybe I should, but I don't because I'm here just trying to take care of my own business. But this pretext for us going in there was that they hate us for our freedoms, so they're working on bomb manufacturing facilities so that they can do everything that they can to destroy America. It's like, no, that's not happening. But I'll tell you what, after 15 years of bombing them, now they probably do hate us for a number of reasons. But it's not because of our freedoms. It's because we're over there bombing and killing their kids.
There's active programs to have them migrate to the West.
Right. Yeah.
It's carried out by NGOs and such. It's
right. Right. And that takes us down this whole new path, which is that these events like Libya gets demolished and then there's a migrant crisis moving into Europe and everyone's like, oh, we got to do something about these migrants. I've got an idea. Stop blowing up their countries. Then they won't migrate. You know, if that's really that big of a problem, then let's just stop at the root of it, which is I would be migrating from Libya too. You know, I would be if I had nothing left there, if it was blown to smithereens, I'd be looking for a place to go. And then you find out that, well, maybe this isn't as organic as we're led to believe, that there are NGOs that are working to facilitate this and that there's an intentional pushing of migrants into Europe to to disrupt the status quo in these countries and create a culture or a community filled with insecurity that leads to police crackdowns. And all these things are essential for removing freedoms and for causing chaos. And it's the whole New World Order motto, order out of chaos. Mm-hmm. Well, they're pretty good at creating chaos, and the order that they want isn't to go back to the rule of law. It's the order that they want is to get everybody under one government so that they can control them. And if people don't believe that, look at the grouping together of countries into the EU and the proposal for the AMERO, of the North American continent that grouping up of Canada, United States, and Mexico that Aaron Russo talked about in his documentary Freedom to Fascism. All these things that he put out there years and years ago sounded crazy at the time, and now you're saying, oh yeah, oh, that's what he was talking about. He was talking about microchipping people back in 2002. Guess what we're seeing in the news? Microchipping. Maybe Aaron Russo was onto something, you know. So all of these, it becomes a bit overwhelming, I think, for most people. And I get it when someone that is just coming into this sort of world and this understanding just kind of throws their hands up and goes, "What am I going to do about this?" You know, like, I get it. We got problems, but like, what do you want me to do about it? I think what I want people to do about it is to know about it, is to understand it, because if you don't understand it, then you're never going to do anything about it. That's for sure. But the first step is to sort of understand the plan, because they're not very creative with the plan. They run the same plan over and over and over again. So it's pretty easy to pick it out. That's why, like with the San Bernardino shooting, I'm not Nostradamus. I just get it. I just understand that there are certain things. There's a narrative that they're pushing, and there's only a couple ways that they're going to sell it, and they're going to keep selling it that way until it stops working. And it'll stop working only when we understand that it's a scam. And I think that maybe the bright side of all of this is that you see the ratings for CNN and MSNBC and Fox News are, you know, are in the tank, or the average viewer's 70 years old or whatever. Mm-hmm. You're starting to see that people are catching on to it, that it's a bit of, you know, it's nonsense, you know, it's not true, and they're tuning it out. And that's a really good first step. Of course, what you do if you're these big major media news organizations, when people start tuning you out and your ratings go down, they don't start telling the truth and gain their followers back. Instead, they try to deplatform the other people that are telling the truth because they don't want competition. So then you see people like, you know, you see Alex Jones, and it's not to say that everything Alex Jones says is true, but you see them going after the alternative media, yeah, because they're a threat to their ratings, and they're also speaking a whole lot of truth at the same time. So it's a double whammy.
Well, you have a lot of independent investigators. Not all of them agree with each other either. There's a lot of rancor within the alternative media truth, yep, community, if you will, because obviously when you're trying to grapple with this and investigate, you're groping around the dark. People have different levels of understanding or consciousness or even interpretation of these events. Not to mention the fact that I think you probably do have agent provocateurs going in and, yep, sort of stirring things up a bit. That's going to be part sort of a co-intel pro operation being carried out. But the idea that some of these people who, you know, the researchers, they can raise a few thousand dollars a month to fund a podcast or just a research, make videos or documentaries, and they get deplatformed. Yeah. All across the board, you know, whether it's YouTube and Google will do it, PayPal will do it, Patreon will do it, they'll get shut down. And like it's, yeah, coordinated. The fact that it's so coordinated, it makes it obvious that obviously there's you could make an antitrust argument here.
For sure. And people are. And that might be one way that these actions stop. But it's obvious to even the most casual observer that it's a coordinated effort. When everybody all at once on the same day deplatforms Alex Jones, that's, yeah, coordinated.
Yeah. And in the law here, I mean, dealing with the internet and some of the free expression on the internet, at least in the United States, was guaranteed by the Communications Decency Act of 1996, I think. And this more or less allowed pornography to be streamed unlimited on the internet. And they call it the Decency Act. But the justification for that is that people provide platforms. They're not like a newspaper. A newspaper has some liability for what they publish. So that's why they have ombudsmen and lawyers who supposedly look after, you know, what they publish. So they have some responsibility. The argument was that they need this freedom because they're going to provide a platform for free expression. And so they get a waiver from this. The telecommunication companies, Google, YouTube, these things, they get a waiver for this because they're providing a free platform. Now they're claiming that they can edit what's carried on their platform. And the whole reason for existing is supposedly for the free expression. Not to mention the fact that outfits like Google or the telecoms in general are all funded with huge amounts of taxpayer money. And you can make the case that it is indeed there's a public claim to the airwaves because they were financed heavily by the taxpayers. Even InQtel, the CIA, funded was it Facebook, and I think Google as well. And so that's the CIA's investment operation. What's the CIA doing that? Well, the CIA is taxpayer funded, therefore we have a claim to that. So that you can't claim that these things are private operations. It's right. Ridiculous.
Right. And the CIA is like, well, listen, we want to get into the, we want to get into the social media business, but we can't call it CIA.gov. Go on there and do your profile page. Yeah. So what we're going to do in a roundabout way is we're just going to finance through our venture capital arm of InQtel. We're just going to finance these other social media platforms and data gathering companies and Keyhole, which later became Google Earth, and all of these different outfits that look like private companies or later to become, if they go public companies. But in actuality, the CIA has a seat at the board or the ownership stake, or they have, they have some say in this, especially if they're getting in with seed funding. I mean, the people that are putting in your seed money in your company have they do so in order to get control and they have a say. And that's, and part of that is a good thing. If you're somebody that's raising money, you want an experienced veteran to not just bring money, but to bring some influence and some advice. And that could be a good thing. But when it's the CIA, it's probably a bad thing.
Yeah.
So,
remember the movie, The Social Network?
Yeah.
About Facebook. And there, the primary funder is, what's his name? What's that venture capitalist guy?
Peter Thiel.
Yeah, Peter Thiel. In the movie, Peter Thiel is the guy that gets it rolling.
Right.
If I recall. The real story is I think they got like 50 times more funding from InQtel.
Yeah.
But that's not mentioned in the movie.
Yeah. And then Peter Thiel goes out and starts Palantir, which is a huge data collection agency for the CIA as well. So, yeah. I mean, there aren't too many degrees of separation between these guys. And one of the things that we saw lately was a company called Media Matters that's run by David Brock came out in a paper to their investors and said, listen, we are going to take down this president. And I want to state right off the bat, I'm not on the red team or the blue team. I don't like either of them. So I'm not a Trumper or a Hillary Clinton person. I'm not into either of those. But Media Matters is definitely Democratic. David Brock is the owner. He is hardcore in with Hillary Clinton. His boyfriend's James Alefantis, which should ring some bells for people. And Media Matters set out and said, listen, we are going to take down this president. We have a strategy for doing that. We have an agreement with Google, or Alphabet, I should say, the parent company. And Facebook and Twitter, they're all on board. They've agreed to be on board to take out the right-wing voices and silence these critics and get this president out of office. And then, boom, what do you see? You see a coordinated effort between Facebook, Google, Twitter to deplatform all these people. Then it spread from there. It went, like you said, to PayPal and Patreon. It went to WordPress. It went to the hosting sites, GoDaddy and places like that. They'd lean on anybody. And when the CIA or the FBI or the DOJ or whoever comes to you and says, listen, you're not putting these people on anymore, or we're going to make your life difficult, and you're thinking, well, listen, I'm running a business. I'm not trying to get political here. This is what I got to do. I'm not saying I agree with it, but I can understand how a company like WordPress would be like, look, we don't want to be in the middle of this. We'll do what you say, but just keep us out of this.
Yeah, the jackals show up.
Exactly. And the jackals show up. And that is, getting back to where we started with John Perkins' book, one of the things he talks about is that he would say that the economic hitmen come in And they make the proposal to the to Ecuador, and they say, you know, we've got this great hydroelectric power plant, and we'll make you very rich, and you take our deal. But for those that said no to it, then he would go back to them and say, listen, I really think you should reconsider. You really need to take this deal, wink, wink. It's very important you take this deal, wink, wink, or something bad might happen. For those that said, General Torrijos, Jaime Roldos, those guys that said, no, we're not doing that. They both died in plane crashes within 3 months of one another. Okay. And that's what he was talking about. He said, when I failed, if I failed to get them on board with the program, we sent in the jackals. And that's what he meant. Those guys were sent in and they blow them up in airplanes or they kill their families or whatever the situation may
be. Horse head in your bed or something.
Yeah, horse head in your bed for sure. And, you know, that has a very everybody's tough until that happens, until you get the knock at your door and it's like, you know, these guys in dark suits.
Well, say, also, like, it's not you. They'll say, you know, you have a cute little daughter there.
Right. He says, right, something like that. Or it'd be a shame if something happened to your to your job. Or, oh, you're a you know, you drive a truck for a commercial license to drive a truck for a living. It'd be a shame if you got a DUI tomorrow. You know, something like that. You know, so it's like, oh God, you know, like they can put pressure on you a million different ways to shut you up. And of course, that happens. And people, you know, have to make that, you know, when they get to that point, they have to make the decision. I mean, there are very few people that are willing to stand up for it. And those that do, you see Gary Webb and Danny Castellaro and authors like that and journalists that have stood up and paid the price for it. So, yeah, it's a scary world. You're dealing with people that do not operate with any sort of social constraints as far as like, oh, I shouldn't do this because this is wrong. they don't care. And they have the protection, so to speak, of the government agencies or the think tanks or whoever it is they're working for, that they know how the game is run. They know they're not going to go to jail for things like that. So yeah, it's a sketchy world. But that is I think that's one of the things that catches people a little bit off guard, is the depths of the evil. You know, how far they're willing to go. You think, you know, you think you've seen a setup before. You think you've seen bad things happen. Just wait till you get into politics. Dr. Dave Janda's got a great story about how when he was first working in Washington, someone pulled him aside and said, don't go to the parties. But if you go to the parties, don't stay for the after parties, because that's when all the bad stuff happens. And next thing you know, you got either something spiked in your drink, and then they're taking pictures of you with a 13-year-old girl, or you're into 13-year-old girls and you willingly go for – or whatever. You know, there's all these compromise organ operations that are set up. And you talked to – you did your interview with Christopher Bolin. You know, he knows about the brownstone operations that the Mossad has pulled. I mean, they're the best at it. They know how to set you up in a way that that compromises you for a long, long time. And if people don't think that that's real, just look at Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, what was he running? He's running a compromised brownstone operation. He's been doing it for a long time, which is the reason why he has the island and the Lolita Express, and why Bill Clinton and Alan Dershowitz and all these scumbags are going off to his island, and they get filmed with underage girls. And next thing you know, deals get done, and you know, they find, you know, they use that leverage to get them to do all kinds of unspeakable things. I had this conversation with Kev Baker, who does the Kev Baker Show, and we're talking about the UK wanting to leave the EU. We're talking about how Ted Heath, the British Prime Minister in the 70s, was very much involved in the getting them involved in the EU, and Britain gave up their fishing rights, which at the time was like they had like 80% control of the fishing industry, and they gave it up to they only have 22% now. And everyone in Britain was like, why did we do this bad deal? Like, what is the point of this? I can't understand why. Well, Ted Heath was a notorious pedophile who was being blackmailed into these horrible deals. So, like, you know, these politicians that we've got that are supposed to be representing of us, most of them have been compromised by the time they get to a position of high office. And then you start to wonder why these deals are so screwy and why these people are such screw ups and why it's because it's intentional. It's because they're not looking for a good guy to get to become a senator or vice president or whatever. They're looking for somebody that has huge skeletons in their closet so that they can be controllable. And I think once people understand that, the political landscape starts to make a lot more sense.
Yeah, that's they're vetted in a negative sense. I mean,
right, exactly.
You don't want an honest man to rise to power, because how do you do business with an honest man? You know.
Yeah, your resume. It's like the opposite of, think of like putting together your resume, and then that's not what they want. All those things that you're showing, like, hey, look at all these positives on my resume. It's like, no. We want to know that you're a pedophile. We want to know that you cheated on your wife, or that you're closeted homosexual, or that you cheated on your taxes, or, you know, they want to know all the bad things. They want to, it's the worst candidate that gets the job, not the best candidate in this case.
Yeah. And it's, an example of that process, the Brownstone operation, would have been Craig Spence's operation in Washington, yes, D.C. in the 1980s. And that ties back to the Franklin scandal. And his idea, he was running a house that had, it was wired for audio visual. He'd blackmail politicians, show up late at night or at a party, stay late, and they'd be compromised. And then once that happens, you have them under control.
Yeah, you didn't hear that from your guidance counselor in high school, did you?
No. What's her name? The FBI translator?
The DC madam?
What was her name? She was a translator for the FBI. She was a whistleblower.
Sybil Edmonds?
Sybil Edmonds. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.
She was talking, I heard her talking with her. She was talking to FBI agent who helps do background checks. I think it was for judicial appointees, I think. And he said, told her that actually they look for dirt on judges, and they're the ones that get appointed.
Yeah. Yeah. The kids for cash deal that was happening. What a scumbag you have to be to do that.
I mean, if people are thinking, you know, what are they talking about? Well, just a couple of years ago, the former Speaker of the House was exposed as a pederast.
Yeah,
and he didn't.
Dennis Hastert was a bad. He was, and he wasn't too far. He was what, three or four steps away from being the president.
Presidency, and of course, I also heard rumors about others in the past. But I heard rumors about him, by the way, in the years leading up to that. But the idea is, he didn't become speaker despite that. He became speaker. His meteoric rise was because of that.
Yeah. It's a weird thing, and once people. I was talking to someone and said, oh, I heard Joe Biden might run for president. I said, he would be awful, but he would be a great candidate as far as the controllers are concerned, because he is all you have to do is go on Google and type in creepy Joe Biden videos, and you'll find endless videos of him trying to take pictures, like in the Oval Office. Come here, little girl, stand closer to Uncle Joe. And you're like, oh my God. I mean, it's total scumbag. But you think, well, he'd never be the president. Well, he shouldn't be the president, but because of that, actually he's more qualified, because I remember telling my mom, like, hey, did you, Joe Biden gave, or I don't know if it was Obama gave Joe Biden or Joe Biden gave Obama a bracelet that had pizza slices on it and everything.
Yeah.
She's like, get out of here. That didn't happen. And I pulled up the picture of them like showing it. And I was like, do you believe me now? Here's the picture of them. She's like, oh my God. I'm like, you don't understand what pizza is referencing, right? She's like, well, I do now because I sort of explained it to him. Like, this is what's going on. This is what's happening. It's hidden in plain sight. If you know what to look for, it's everywhere. You know what I mean? You know those paintings that you look at where you stare at it, just looks like a bunch of lines, and you stare at it and you're supposed to, oh, there's an elephant. And once you see the elephant, you can always see the elephant. Well, it's like that in politics. If you just look at it with normal vision, it all just, you're just seeing lines. But once someone says, you know, they're all pedophiles, right? You go, oh my God, it all makes so much more sense now. So that's part of that awakening process too.
And what's happened was, I think in more conservative times, perhaps in the 50s and 60s, infidelity was enough. But then along came the sexual revolution, so greater perversions are necessary to blackmail people.
Right.
We've come a long way, baby.
we certainly have. Well, he's a closeted homosexual. Ooh, let's use that. Well, now it gets to the point where if you're a pedophile, if you're cheating on your wife, you can get divorced or you can just come out and get busted. If you're a homosexual, a closeted homosexual, you could be out and you go, look, I'm gay. All right, no big deal. If you're a pedophile, they got you forever. That's you can't just come out of the closet on that one. That's one that they've got you. That's the royal flush of compromised behavior. So
and they're working on, they're working on destroying that taboo. So
yeah, and that's a weird thing too. And you go, you go, well, you know, much like the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act, you look at it and you go, isn't it working just fine the way it is? Why do you guys have to? Why are you guys trying to fix this problem that's not a problem? Well, then you start to realize, well, they're trying to normalize the pedophilia angle because there's a bunch of pedophiles that really don't want it to be taboo anymore because they know that, you know, if it gets out that they are one, that they're in a lot of trouble. But and that is a. Was it Tom Daschle that came out and said that they were trying to normalize a dozen different perversions? I think it was him talking about how that was that he had been a part of some plan that they were trying to normalize that. And you go, God, that seems like a lot of work to like. Why would that be? Is that a priority? Do we need that?
Well, look at all the transgender stuff. That's just the best, you know, couple years. Where it's become where. You know, public accommodations and policies are, newspaper, precious, you know, space on newspapers and columns written about the stuff, which are, was just 10 years ago was considered something that was so marginal, not to really bother the time of the public. But now it becomes everywhere in the news. It's North Carolina is attacked by the New World Order for reversing that, for having the audacity to think that men and women should have separate bathrooms,
right?
What bathroom you should use should be based on your birth sex, as if there's any other sex. But that's the whole. Right. See, this is not.
Right. I have legitimate sympathy for anybody that is born in is born transgendered and has this sort of confusion. It must be incredibly difficult to go through your entire life, especially adolescence, and have that, and it's got to be really tough. But if you watch the news, they would have you think that it was like contagious or something, or that it was like it was like an epidemic. But I think that I don't think the numbers match the media.
Well, the problem is they do it at the expense of other issues like the explosion and the rate of autism.
Right. You go, hey, let's talk about, this is an interesting topic, but, why don't you guys on the news, we've only got a half an hour each night, right, on the nightly news. Like, are we prioritizing things? Because, this seems to not be a real issue. This seems like maybe we should talk about, I don't know, the bullshit wars that we're still involved in 17 years later. Are we going to talk about, hey, everybody, why are we still in Afghanistan? Let's talk about transgendered instead. So it's a distraction sort of.
And or it's how deflated Tom Brady's ball is.
Right. Yeah, in the book, I mentioned you're talking about the eight tentacles.
Yeah.
I think people think that the military is the most dangerous. Well, it is in a sense that it kills people, obviously. But I think the media is the most dangerous because they normalize behavior that shouldn't be normalized. They normalized war in the United States as if it's like no big deal. And it was intentional. It was through the use of, ambiguous words or changing the war on terror, which is it doesn't make any sense if you think about it, because a war is terror. So how can you have a war on terror? Because war itself is terror. But it's so Orwellian that it makes your head hurt. But we've watched the media either through outright lies or the omission of important stories, like we're just talking about. They've controlled they really have controlled the minds of the American people. We're all guilty of having that happen to us. Even all of us that are, supposedly awake on some level, it's happened to us. We've fallen under that victim. It's a very powerful, enemy. It's a very powerful medium for control, and they have used it to their advantage. And the consolidation into these smaller and smaller groups of conglomerates, these media conglomerates. You would think, in theory, you could boil it all down to one media group, which would just be telling the truth. But of course, we know that's not how it works. You actually want to have multiple media sources, because then it keeps a check on everybody else. When you've got 50 companies that control all the media, it's actually better for you than if you have five, because the five can easily skew it and tell lies. Whereas if you've got 50, you know, you might have 47 of them lying, and then three of them are going, hey, you know, these other guys are just lying to you. This is all nonsense.
Yeah.
So when you remove that and make it boil it down to a smaller group, instead of getting closer to the truth, you get closer to the lies.
Well, you don't have to necessarily be conspiratorial. You can just make the connections of interlocking directorates and financial interest, because the same corporations that own the major media companies that rely on for information are corporations that make money hand over fist with these wars, not to mention they're tied into big pharma.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think of General Electric as being one of those those companies. It's got such a disarming name, you know. Oh, well, they make light bulbs. Well, they do. They also make bombs. And they also control the media. They also have own NBC. Mm-hmm. So it's like they can use their media outlets to create a war. And if you think the media can't create a war, they can. They did. And they've been doing it for a long, long time.
I think they've created every war.
I think they have. Yeah.
I can't think of any war. This is the Spanish-American War. First World War. America's involvement in that, at least. The Second.
Yeah.
War. Yeah. Korea.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I always make joke about Vietnam. Vietnam. You alluded to it earlier about the Gulf of Tonkin being the justification for the escalation that became the Vietnam War is an event that never happened. But then a few years later, 1967, there actually was an attack on an American ship, USS Liberty, that did occur, but the media didn't report on it. So the media reporting on events that didn't happen that lead to a war, and ignoring an event that did happen, and an event that would have justified a declaration of war.
And you wonder why they hate the alternative media, because they're constantly pointing out these inconsistencies and the hypocrisy of the media landscape. Those things I hope people are waking up to. I think that maybe they're not as distrustful as the media as I am, but I think a lot of people are sort of waking up to the fact that, you know, the media is kind of full of it. Unfortunately, there are still a whole lot of people in a certain age, you know, the older age demographic that you know, grew up trusting their nightly news.
This is the boomers.
And they're still stuck in it. But I mean, the numbers are out showing that the younger demographic is getting their news online, and online news is less controllable than the major media corporations, although they're trying to control the online, as we talked about. I mean, they're trying to get a handle on it, but that is, I would imagine, their greatest fear, because you've got a whole new generation that just might not believe in their nightly news the way the boomers did with Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather, and before that, you know, from Kennedy on. You know, you sort of found your news anchor that you liked. You turn on that nightly news every night. You sort of, oh, I'm a Peter Jennings guy. Oh, really? Well, I'm a Tom Brokaw guy. You know, so that is
Dan Rather wears a sweater.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. So he must be telling the truth.
I remember that. I don't know if you're old enough to remember that, when he started wearing a sweater, it became a news story in and of itself, what the anchors were wearing.
He's like, well, Mr. Rogers does it, and people believe him. So maybe I'll throw one on.
Dan Rather is one that misrepresented the Zapruder film for everybody.
Right, exactly, which is why he's got a great career. He later came out, though, which was funny, and I put it in the book, talking about how if you're a journalist and you speak out against the war, they tend to put flaming tires around your neck.
Yeah.
and he said, I would like to say that I was above all that, but unfortunately I wasn't. So he sort of confessed there that he understood that he was very much a part of
well,
continuing
this is how
that.
It works. I interviewed Doug Valentine a while back. Doug Valentine, you're familiar with him?
No, who's he?
He just writes, he wrote a book, he pretty much wrote the definitive book on the Phoenix program. He also wrote a book called CA as Organized Crime, I recommend to you.
Oh, okay.
He's just this guy.
Right up my alley.
he's a great researcher, a writer, and he wrote a book about the Phoenix program. And it was published, but it was suppressed by the CIA indirectly. He found it out years later. Just how it works is he got access to the director. What's his name in the 70s?
Colby?
Colby, yeah, the one they found dead in the canoe.
Yep. Totally normal.
Yeah. Yeah. Colby, who actually, but Colby himself was tied to the Frankenskin. I mean,
he was. What a surprise. Yeah.
I mean, he was tied in a way he was brought in by the. He was consulting with the Nebraska legislature who was investigating it. And he's the one that told, what's his name? The Nebraska legislature was looking into it. The guy who wrote the Franklin scandal, the Franklin cover up book.
Oh,
I think it's called the Franklin name. Scandal. The name fails me now. He's dead now. He's a state senator. But they knew each other in Vietnam. But anyway, he's the one that told him that, yeah, there are things that are so you can never do anything about that, you know, that are so bad. He told him that. Anyway, that's a digression. He was Colby. Valentine had gained the confidence of Colby because Doug Valentine's father was a World War II vet who signed up early. He was too young, but he signed up and got caught by the Japanese in the Philippines, one of the islands out there, and was put into a prisoner of war camp. And what happens is in that camp, some of the British officers made a deal with the Japanese guards or administrators of the camp that should anyone try to escape, they'd report them. And they did. So a couple of him and Australians got there and murdered the officer who told on him. This was covered up by the U.S. military, and his father's record was completely faked. And so he found out about this years later, and his father was suffering anxiety because he couldn't tell anyone about his wartime experience. And he realized that the government could fake anyone's war record and create a fake career or experience. But this he wrote the story of his father in the book Hotel Tacloban about his father's experience, and he sent it to Colby, and Colby liked it so much because Colby was in the war, so he thought he could have had something in common with him. So and Doug Valentine wanted to write a book about the Phoenix program, and through the introduction to Colby, he was able to go to all these different people who administered the Phoenix program and write this book about it. It came out that the book was going to be critical of it, so they offered him a job, like $80,000 a year, on some Senate committee, by the way, Senate Oversight Committee, which is kind of funny. Tells you how oversight works, agencies, okay?
Did they buy up his entire first edition?
Oh, no, what they did was they said, okay, he rejected. He said, no, I don't want to work for you. I want to be a writer, these things. But they trashed it in the New York Times Review of Books.
Mm.
Morley Safer trashed it.
Oh.
Okay, CBS. So they got Morley Safer to write this, to condemn this, you know, this obscure book in the pages of the New York Times. And it turned, years later, he got a call. He found out that Morley Safer Morley Safer admitted years later to some speech that in Vietnam, he was taken under the wing of Bill Colby to show him all that was going on in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And make him, Morley Safer kind of made his bones in Vietnam. This is kind of like CNN making their bones in the Gulf War.
Right.
And he found out that years later that Colby got in touch with Morley Safer to have him write that review.
Whoa.
He called in his favor. So this is, that's just a one illustration, right?
Yeah.
You know, so I guess they could have killed him. They didn't feel it was necessary because it's easier just to suppress the information.
Right.
You know, than do that. So that's just one example how information is controlled. Another example we talk about the media, and this is mass communication. Mass communication was developed for the purposes of psychological warfare and misinformation and manipulation. It didn't develop to educate the people, entertain the people, and it was developed to manipulate the masses from the get-go. And this goes back to the Radio Research Project in Princeton. You know, like the Halloween Eve broadcast of War of the Worlds was done as a psychological warfare operation. We know this now, right? Well, I mean, we know that it wasn't whoops. It was done on purpose. And this is leading up to the war. It's, you know, they're getting us ready for the Second World War. But there's a book called The Science of Coercion by Christopher Simpson. He's an academic, I think, American University. And he's very standard. You know, he's not a radical. He's writing about mass communication. From the get-go, for this radio or television, the only people that studied the influence of mass communication it was first the War Department, the Pentagon, and then the CIA. And so it was always developed with that in mind. So when we look at something like, what's the, Mockingbird, Operation Mockingbird.
Right.
You're familiar with that?
Yes, I am.
And so what does that tell you? I mean, Operation Mockingbird means they've controlled, and this is the broke in the 70s, you know, the hearings in the 70s, but hundreds of journalists, and really, you don't have to buy every journalist. You just have to control the editors of the newspapers. Right. And it was admitted that hundreds of journalists were put on the pay of the CIA to write favorable stories, you know, for the agency or for the corporations that control the agency, you know. And so this is an old game. It's
what that it explains why the CIA gave my book one star on Amazon.
Yeah. So I mean, and when you realize that all the networks, and this is obvious, all the networks, ABC, I think it was Sarnoff, came out of the Office of War Information. Paley, I think, was with OSS. He was CBS News. Edward Murrow was an actor before he was a journalist, and he came out of that milieu too.
Yeah,
you know, they're all actors and they're all agents, and they're there to, you know, they have stage names often, right? Even though they aren't their real names. So and it is a production. It's a show. It's there to beguile and entertain us. It's not there to provide any information. So, you know, the idea that the media is there to, you know, we pay them more indirectly to sort of get the information, collate it, put it in a package in a boat for us so we can read it and we can be informed citizens and we can all go vote. Does it work that way? No.
No. No, 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 no. And I think that once people wake up to that reality, then it starts, the mass media starts to make a whole lot more sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I am constantly screaming at my television, you know, just like, how dare you? How dare you say that? How stupid do you think we are? Well, I mean, it's been 50 years of control. So for people to say, well, you know, the CIA might have a hand. The CIA has been involved in the mainstream media since the 50s and 60s, and it's not even up for debate. I mean, it's declassified through Operation Mockingbird, and that's the best case scenario. We've got a whole new batch of stuff that we probably don't even know about in terms of flicker rates of your computer screen, and you've mm-hmm. got Steve Jobs saying, oh, I would never let my kids use an iPad, and you're like, Jesus, really? Why?
Yeah.
What do you know that we don't know? You're the guys that invented it, you know. And so for people that are coming to the realization that maybe the mainstream media, maybe your nightly news is not telling you the entire full story, well, guess what? They never have been, and it's been set up that way. It's been the most effective disinformation platform that they could have ever hoped for, except maybe now I think social media is gaining a foothold. Maybe eventually we'll surpass the nightly news as the biggest form of disinformation. And, you know, bringing back the conversation about Chris Bolin talking about how how Hollywood has been very integral in coming up with stories that are predictive programming of things like 9/11, you know, happening. You go as it's happening and as you're seeing it, it's hard to sort of envision what that means in the future. But then once it's happened and you look back on it, it's all very clear. You know, it's very clear that Hollywood has had a hand in this. And then you understand that the Department of Defense has its own branch that is, you know, that the Hollywood studios need to get approval from in order to use their tanks and aircraft carriers and things like that for movies. Well, the DOD has final script approval. If you do that, if you agree to their terms, it gives them script approval as well. And that's in a book that I've been working on that's just about to come out. And I talked about part of that, and it's not just Mission Impossible and Hurt Locker and all these movies, but it's like Ernest Saves Christmas also had I'm not even kidding, I'm not even being silly here, I'm being 100% that it had DOD approval, and I'm like, why, what does that have to do with anything? But like, they're involved in every movie out,
like TV shows like Cupcake Wars and
right,
Cutthroat Kitchen, and that's all part of the sort of the, I think, the broader cultural programming that they want to that they're involved in. This is the psych. I mean, they do spend a lot of money in psychological warfare.
They don't call it cupcake hugs. It's cupcake wars.
Yeah. And if you look at some of the narcissism and sort of the, if you look at these programs, obviously they're pushing narcissism, so-called reality shows psychopathic or sociopathic behavior.
Yeah,
that they encourage these things. This is the type of behavior that's promoted. Dexter. That's another thing. The good serial killer. That's another thing with a lot of these TV shows where, the values are being promoted. You can even quality shows like Breaking Bad or something, which has some sort of revelatory element to it. How the drug war goes, but then there's always the cover up, because they don't show what's really going on. It's a limited hangout effect.
Yeah, and I bring up that, I'll bring that up to friends. They'll say, "Will you just shut up so I can enjoy this show, for God's sakes? Do you have to bring this in? Can I just watch Breaking Bad without thinking about how it's a drug angle?"
Yeah.
How it's the DEA and CIA are really involved in this. They're like, just let me enjoy this thing.
Yeah. And if you're familiar with the work of like Catherine Austin Fitz about.
Yes, I am.
About the drug war and just what the narco dollar is as important as the petrodollar. To understand global politics and these wars, there's a reason why every time there's a war, whether it's Afghanistan or the dirty war in Central America or Vietnam, these become lucrative drug trade routes.
Yeah. Yeah, and private prison, and then that fuels the private prison industry. She's got a good Dylan Reed in the
Aristocracy.
Aristocracy, exactly. Yeah, it's a great. It lays out in a pretty easy to understand method how the private prison industry was brought about, and it wasn't accidental, and who put it in place, and how these. How high powerful law firms got together with private businesses to create private prison industry, and then they fund campaigns for politicians. Reinventing government for sure. And the omnibus crime bill that Bill Clinton went out and played saxophone on Arsenio Hall and got all the black community to love him and vote for him and made him president, and then he put them all in prison. On extended drug sentences where they made it, he screwed them in the end by putting them in private prisons. And then you realize, well, he was backed by these guys.
He had a big role in getting that cheap crack cocaine in L.A. because of Mena, Arkansas.
Yeah. Yes, he did.
In partnership with the Bushes. That's another.
The Bushes, exactly.
It's like, who Barry Seal was? No. Well, then, nothing of a. How the real world, how these things work,
it's too much, like you said. It's tough to go back and have to educate someone because it's hard to know where to start. But it's like you said, you'll pick one person. You say, well, go find out who Barry Seal was. Go research who he was, or go take a look at Mena, Arkansas. Research that, and that will explain a little bit more about. Where Bill Clinton came from and his ties to the Bush family. Mm-hmm. And, yes, V.S. Bush ran for re-election and he lost to Bill Clinton. But really, did he really lose? Because that was his buddy. That was his guy. And he was actually, Bill continued the tradition of, they were all kind of on the plane for the same team. And that makes a little bit more sense. And, so one thing leads to another. But, yeah, for someone that's trying to get into trying to wrap their head around this whole thing, it's a bit much to bite off. But I would suggest pick a topic that interests you that has has some personal relevance for you. And get into that, and then that will lead you to other things. Like if someone in your family got, God forbid, got put in prison on a crack cocaine charge, and you go, well, it always seemed unfair. It is unfair. The sentence for powdered cocaine was 1/100th of the sentence for crack cocaine. Mm-hmm. Do you think that was accident? It's basically the same thing. You just add baking powder to it and cook it up, and it's the same thing. But why is the sentence different? Well, it's different because crack cocaine was seen as a black drug. Powdered cocaine was seen as a white drug, and there was a desire to put the black community in jail, in prison for long stretches and break up the family and do all these things. You go, oh my God, that just sounds like too much work. It is a lot of work, but that's what's really happening. I mean, the things that seem random and accidental are not random and accidental. They are joined together at a deeper level. And that's what I think some people are starting to figure that out. It makes a whole lot more sense. Talk to somebody that's in prison, that's been in prison for a long, long time. Chris Hedges talks about how he teaches in a prison. He says, those are the most educated people that I talk to. They know all about the law. They know all about what's going on in society because they've been victims of it. And so who better to talk to than the people that have been victimized by it, because they understand it. It's very personal to them. So,
you ever see the movie Trading Day with Denzel Washington, where he's reading the paper in the diner?
And yes.
The white cop there, Ethan Hawke, he's naive and
yep.
Not let me read my paper. He says, I read this paper, 90% of it is BS, but it entertains me.
Yeah,
he's a corrupt cop who knows how corrupt the power structure is. Just below the surface, just below the surface. And then once you get a peek into that, you realize that much of what you're hearing, I mean, I look into a lot of things, whether anything from, and things take on a different meaning. There's a different level of complexity understanding. I understand it's hard for people. It's too much to swallow in one bite. I understand it. Well, don't swallow it in one bite. Often when I'm in a face of the situation like you described, whether it's Thanksgiving dinner, I have a dozen people shouting at me, asking me questions, and then interrupting me before I answer the question with another question or accusation, my response is, well, one issue, one conspiracy at a time.
Yeah.
One conspiracy at a time. Then when you start to get a sort of a whole holistic understanding of these things, because it is tied. When you talk about these eight tentacles, they all lead back to the same head, and that's an apt description, because it does, because the medical, the spiritual, the scientific, the financial, the physical, covert is key to this. Yeah. They're all tied together. Yeah. And again, if you don't look like, if you don't like to think of it as a conspiracy theory, think of it as a business model. How they look at it.
Well, Catherine Austin Fitz talks about that. She says, so much of what people consider conspiracy theory are just people working in concert to protect their money.
Yeah.
And if that makes it easier for people to understand it that way, then think of it that way, because that's true. I mean, there's evil aspects to it, but a lot of it is control, and a lot of it is managing, either making money or protecting the money that they currently have. She's absolutely right. Isn't she brilliant? I love her.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something you read something like, what was her book? She wrote that piece on the drug trade. I guess it begins with a story about Dick Grasso, the head of the president of the New York Stock Exchange, meeting with the FARC guerrillas, and trying to get them to invest their cocaine money in Wall Street as opposed to spending it locally, and they don't. And then Plan Colombia goes into effect, where they also were at war with them. And you realize that the drug war really is just a series. What the drug war really is the federal government cracking down on small-time drug dealers, at the same time managing the drug trade by favoring one cartel against another at a given time. And those alliances switch.
That's why Manuel Noriega is in prison, and he's like, I was working with these guys. I don't know why I'm in prison all of a sudden. We were partners. Well, don't go into business with the CIA.
Yeah, yeah. And again,
what did you think was going to happen?
And he was paid like $100,000 a year, $110,000 a year, a retainer. I guess there's that. Who's the DEA agent who actually is naive, but I think like in the 1980s, the 85, Sonny Costillo is his name, I think.
Okay.
A DEA who asked George Bush about it when he was George Bush's vice president. And George Bush just kind of laughed it off, but then also he found himself railroaded after he started raising questions about DEA and CIA collusion in the drug trade down there in Central America.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. If you ask George Bush about it, well, you ask the right guy. I mean, I give him credit for that, because he certainly asked the guy that would know all about it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, maybe not in the way that he thought. He thought, hey, maybe you could help me out and to stop all this.
The funny thing about running it is, it's not, if you know the history of one thing, the opium trade in establishing these large banking houses and the Boston Brahmin, it was the Russell Trust through the opium trade, which then finances the creation of Skull and Bones, this elite society, which pretty much, at least throughout the 20th century, kind of ran the show, both financial and political. So the opium trade plays an important role in establishing, well, the British Empire was the largest, was the most successful narco state ever. And to this day, you'll have like someone like Lyndon LaRouche will say this. People think you're nuts, because he's Lyndon LaRouche's nuts, of course. But what he's saying is essentially true.
Right. so much of what people that have dug into this, when they say it's true and it sounds nuts to someone that's hearing it for the first time, you know, people will say, you know, a lot of times the topics I get off on, they'll say, this sounds crazy. I don't deny that it sounds crazy. It does sound crazy. But just because it sounds crazy doesn't mean it isn't true.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you talked about the British Empire through opium. I mean, they discovered that. Oh, wait a second. Silk? Spices? No. We found something even more profitable. Mm-hmm. And we can enslave a whole population at the same time, get them hooked on it, and really screw them up. Is it any surprise that what fueled the British Empire is fueling the American Empire? Of course not. I mean, that's a great way to run your empire, because it's everyone wants, you know, people want to get high, and they make that available under the guise of prohibiting it, which of course keeps the price high, mm-hmm. and allows you to put people in prison that you don't like or that cross you. It's a genius strategy. It's evil, of course, but it's genius.
Yeah. Do you have the quote from the Nixon? Is it Haldeman's quote about using?
No, but I know. But what he talked about was, I don't know. I don't have the quote, but yeah, it's something along the lines of, you know, they used heroin for the black community and marijuana for the white community to put these – not the white community, but the anti-war community,
yeah.
to marginalize and criminalize them so that they could put them in prison so that they couldn't vote against the Nixon administration,
yeah.
which is both evil and genius at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And you also have that CIA psychiatrist, Jolyon West, had a similar quote about the use of drugs, as you can use it not only to I guess to opiate a certain group, weaken them, but also to selectively target them, and
yeah.
particularly minority groups. And this is a guy, you know, the CIA. He's the guy who gave LSD to Elephant, Oklahoma, killed him. And he's sort of like a zealot figure because he shows up. He apparently met with you know, what's his name? The guy who shot Lee Harvey Oswald.
Jack Ruby,
and these also had connections to Timothy McVeigh later on.
Oh, wow.
And also also to the alleged assassin of RFK. So this figure shows up.
Sirhan.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of these figures. But he had similar quotes about the use of drugs and these things, of course.
Don't buy acid from that guy.
No, yeah. And, of course, the LSD itself was proliferated by the CIA in the United States. That's well documented now there, the Johnny Appleseed, you know, of that. Not to mention, again, it was the intelligence operation, these dirty wars that established a drug trade, allowed things like heroin to flow into the United States in the wake of the Vietnam War.
Yeah. Well, I wonder how many people, you know, I wonder how many soldiers coming back from Afghanistan are starting to wake up and realize, why are we down here guarding these poppy fields?
Yeah.
Like, why are we – this seems like a waste of our time. Well – if you know what the game is, it's kind of part of the game.
Yeah, and now more people are dying from prescription drugs than illegal drugs.
Right.
It's a
bad situation. But I think that part of this is that if people can kind of start to understand what's going on, some aspects of it, and then use that to fuel their curiosity to learn about some other new aspects, and then share that with friends, provided that they're sharing the right information. Try and get it as accurate as you can get.
Mm-hmm.
The awareness is probably the best step for us in order to turn the ship around. But boy, it has been. I think it's important for people to understand that it's been screwed up for a long, long time, and it's by design. And awareness to the problem, the situation is the first step, like any good addict, right? You have to admit that you have a problem, right? So we have to admit we have a problem. We have a problem with the governments that we're living under lying to us, and we have a problem that they are not operating in our best interest, that we vote – every election we vote against our own best interest, and we do so willingly, and we put little stickers on ourselves, and we put it on Facebook, and we say, hey, look, I voted. Well, you know, let's understand what that exactly means and how I forget who it was that said it, that if voting voting actually worked, they'd make it illegal.
Yeah.
You know? So unfortunately, that's sort of the world that we live in. But I do have optimism, though. I don't want it to come across that I'm so down that this is a sinking ship that we can't salvage. But because we can. And in this, you know, we talked about the media or the mainstream media and the corporations freaking out and shutting down free speech on the internet and deplatforming people and everything. It's as awful as that is, and as alarming as that is, it's also a good sign. It's also a sign that it's effective and that they are freaking out. Because if it wasn't affecting them, if it wasn't having an impact on their scam for global control, then you wouldn't see these reactions. You wouldn't see these overreactions because. You wouldn't see the pushback, the fake news. Oh, everything, you know, oh, that's fake news. Listen, if it's fake news, if it's so fake, why do you have to tell us it's fake? If it's fake, it's fake. It's fake on its face. We don't need the government to protect me from the National Enquirer. Why do you all of a sudden have to get involved in Facebook and have Facebook hire 10,000 people that are going to sift through fake news and sort that out for us? Like, maybe the reason why they're overreacting to the fake news is because it's not fake.
Yeah. And of course, then they're the largest practitioners of fake news.
Of course.
They've been caught. I mean, it's...
Of course. It's maddening in some respects where want to shake your head.
I mean, you've mentioned it before, that CNN thing from the Gulf War.
Yeah.
Carl Jacko is his name.
Oh, my God. Charles Jacko.
Charles Jacko. And I show that to people. So, look, they're faking a missile attack. So you look at that and says, don't you look at... Maybe perhaps other reports from that war, and think maybe you're watching a fake attack, and what are you seeing now is actually being faked.
Yeah, right?
I mean, especially now since the technology is such.
Oh yeah.
So my point is, whenever you see something, you're seeing television itself as a medium, so you got to be suspect, right? Anything you see on television. So.
For sure.
You know, but people will watch that, then go back to the news and accept what they see on that very same network. About something, yeah. You know.
Yeah, I don't try. I mean, I don't even believe CNN's weather reports. They have such little credibility in my book that I question that.
Yeah, but even I mean, you don't get like I've done interviews about sports, like professional sports being rigged, and yeah, it makes sense that obviously something, especially the influence, if you look at the revenue of professional sports compared to gambling, and it's like. At a conservative estimate, it's 10-1, and yeah. So you don't think gambling's gonna have an impact on what you see on the field?
Yeah, my background is in pro sports. I had a sports media company, so yeah, I lived in Las Vegas for a long, long time.
And
so
now Las Vegas is getting a football team.
Yeah, and that was always the big problem that the NFL had. They said, "Well, the gambling's gonna affect it." The gambling in Las Vegas is 1% of the sports gambling that's happening in the United States. Yeah. The rest is either offshore or with bookies. Like, listen, if they wanted to rig the NFL, it would be rigged. Having a professional sports teams in Las Vegas, it is not a problem. Yeah, the only problem is for the visiting teams who come in and get hammered out of their minds the night before and then go play, you know, then have to go play a hockey game against the Golden Knights and all those Canadian guys on the other team are you know, hungover. But
I argue about that. There are people that, you know, they claim that some sports franchises are favored over others because they're worth more. So the referees will favor them. Because you want a player to be promoted for a certain reason,
right.
And they'll agree to that, but they don't think that's fixed. Well, that's rigging. You're rigging a game. You're rigging an outcome. I mean, not to mention point shaving and all that stuff. And you know, there's a reason why was it just when you had that merger in the late '60s with the NFL and AFL that critical moment when people didn't take the AFL seriously that two AFL teams won the Super Bowl.
So. Yeah. Yep. All of a sudden, it's oh God, I can't go down the sports rabbit hole tonight.
It legitimizes it. But anyway, I'm saying it's like anything else, it's entertainment, and there's no law against it. My point is, there is no law against it. There's, you know, not for teams internally doing it. There's a law against like criminals coming, you know, organized crime doing it and all that stuff.
And the referee, and Tim Donaghy going to prison for point shaving.
I'm sure he's the only one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, he's the only guy doing it.
Well, listen, anything else? I mean, anything else you want to say about your book?
No. Well, like I said earlier, I think your audience will like it. I think your audience will understand a lot of it that's in there. But I think that it might even be better for those that aren't listening to this show, for mm-hmm. people that are listening, that to buy it for somebody in their lives that you know, maybe you've gone as far as you can go with your brother-in-law, you know, and then you're done discussing 9/11, or you're done discussing some one of these events. Buy the book, send it to them. Let me be the bad guy. They'll take a peek at it. They'll read some of it. It's funny too. I got to be honest. I as dark as some of these topics are, I had to infuse some humor.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I got
humor.
I get a bit funny in there, and that's to keep people from jumping off the roof. You know what I mean? There are some, you know, we're talking about some events that are pretty powerful and evil, and some people that are very evil. So it's nice to hear George Carlin's take on things, who, by the way, after if you go back and watch yes. his comedy acts, it is like he should have been a history teacher, because what he's talking about is so relevant. And so I put as much of that in there as I could. And yes, there's tons of quotes from Hitler and Mao and Hillary Clinton and the people that are in politics, and those evil people. But there's just as many quotes from hilarious figures as well. And when you hear Bill Hicks talk about some of his thoughts on politics, it just makes you kind of laugh out loud. So I wouldn't say it's good reading for the entire family, but it is definitely interesting for people that want to get a new version of history. I felt like after all these years, I had to unlearn everything I learned in history class, because so much of it just really was not even close to being the truth, and understanding that agenda. And I also get into the book and I get into the education system and how that was corrupted and how that was intentional. And God, you know, we've got the schools that are set up and are churning out American students that are unqualified for everything. And I will, you know, I argue that it is not accidental, that it has been by design, and that's reprehensible, in my opinion.
Yeah, the dumbing down of America. It's
undeniable, and mm-hmm. it's a shame, and it needs to stop, and it can stop. And like I said before, it's first part of it is awareness to understand, like, hey, listen, we're not letting this Common Core program in my school, because there's no explanation for it other than it is an intentional dumbing down of students. And what the purpose of that is debatable, but the setup for it is Bill Gates is in charge of it. That's all you need to know. I mean, Bill Gates is behind some of the worst things in the world. So
yeah, openly talks about using vaccines to sterilize people to reduce. Yeah, he talks about reproductive health to reduce the population. Wait a second, is this?
Yeah,
I think reproductive health should be like increased.
Well, I put in the book that Henry Kissinger says that 50% of the world's population should be reduced. And I say, that's great, Henry. Let's start by cutting you in half.
Yeah, that's always it's always someone else who has to be sacrificed for the greater good. It's
right. Never... Ted Turner talks about, we got to get rid of all the 90% of the population. Yeah. You have 5 kids. Mm-hmm. Which one of your kids is going to live, Ted? Because we got to get rid of the other 4.
Yeah.
You know? So it's the hypocrisy of this.
Yeah, and it's Henry Kissinger, who 1974 National Security Study Memorandum talked about, you know, immiserating and impoverishing the third world for the purposes of reducing the population, you know, by about 25, 30 million. You know,
yeah,
and you know, and you a lot of this is brought about by, you know, increased debt. You talk about this debt model, the economic hit model that we're talking about. A lot of that was created by this debt model, and also the perpetrated or created energy crisis of the 1970s,
which
played a big role in. Yeah,
and so when George Carlin talks about we love dropping bombs on brown people, he's not kidding.
No, it's yeah.
I mean, he's making a joke of it, but he's not wrong.
Yeah, it's. Yeah, so and of course for the white faces out there, you're not immune to this. So
no, they're coming for you next. I'm as white as they come. I couldn't get any whiter, mm-hmm. and I have to
look at your European civilization today. It's being targeted, and that's another thing is they use the quote brown people as sort of proxy that, you know.
Yeah.
So you blame the immediate enemy when you're not blaming the oligarch who's sending them in there to disrupt society. It's NATO. It's George Soros. You know, it's these NGOs. Yeah. It's the banks that are disrupting the Middle East. You know, the North African Middle East rim there to create this diaspora into Europe that's being facilitated. Same thing in Central America. Decades and decades of, you know, of the West going in there and screwing up these countries. Then you have this that, you know, this migration north, which is a problem, but a lot of Americans just deal with the immediate problem with which is the immigration, but they don't confront the crimes of their governments and the corporations that they often work for and buy things from for decades have been going to these countries, you know, like Honduras, yeah. Guatemala, there's the El Salvador option in the 80s, that the dirty wars of the 80s in Central America, Nicaragua. There's Guatemala in 1954, you know, yep. for the purposes of United Fruit Company. Same yep. thing in Iran and these things. So, you know, it's a you have to understand the long history of these things to really get a grasp of it.
Yeah, and one thing I came to understand after, you know, during the course of writing the book was that, and I take no pleasure in saying this as an American, but we're the problem. We're the enemy. We're the terrorists. And I hate to say it, but that is what I've come to understand. I don't mean you and me, of course, but I mean our governments and our corporations, mm-hmm. which are now multinational corporations, but we have been the problem. It's projection. It's projecting onto these other countries the crimes of that which we are guilty of, and it is a classic sociopathic trait to do that. And unfortunately, we've been doing it for a long, long time. Russia. Russia's not the problem. It's us. Mm-hmm. We're the problem, you know. And I hate saying that, but and I know some people that'll rub some people the wrong way. But that is, you know, unfortunately, well, people outside of the United States will say, "Yeah, we know."
Yeah,
you tell us something we don't know. I mean, they see it. They understand what's been happening, and it's a shame, and it's embarrassing, and I'm offended that in the name of my country we've started wars all over the planet and have done some pretty unspeakable things to countries in the name of spreading democracy or humanitarian crisis or all these buzzwords that mean the exact opposite. And it's just a shame. It really is just a shame. And I think that the people that are behind it should be exposed. They should be called out by name, and they should be made to pay for their crimes. Some of, you know, whoever the ones that are still alive and still perpetrating this, and hopefully we'll see that. But I'm not holding my breath.
No, probably not. Not in our lifetime, no.
Unfortunately.
Well, okay. Well, I've had your fair amount of time. I want to thank you for coming on the show again.
Oh, I could talk to you all night long. This is great. Thank you so much for having me on. This is really, it's fun. We're doing what we can.
Yeah, you have a lot of experience. Particularly, one of these things, you know, maybe focus on one of these things like financial.
Sure.
Which is maybe have you back in the near future. Talk about you. Focus on one. Maybe pick on focus on one particular issue that you raised in there. That's one thing I found in your book was it's. I found it useful is you could go through a particular chapter, and you just get a sort of a rundown on an issue, highlights these quotes and these things, bullet points. I actually used it for a couple of shows that I did after reading the book.
Well, that's the one compliment I've been getting from people is thank you for bullet points. Bullet points are awesome. They make it a lot easier. So I like them. They're easy to read. They're easy to just kind of check through 1, 2, 3. So, it's a big book for sure, but I like to think it's easy to read and it's worth the price of admission just for the quotes. It's available at Amazon as a Kindle and a paperback. And it's also available on barnesandnoble.com as a paperback and as an ebook.
Excellent. That's The Octopus of Global Control by Charlie Robinson. Yep. Okay. Well, thank you. I'll wish you a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Same to you. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks. Good night, then.
Father Christmas, I stood outside a department store. A gang of kids came over and mugged me and knocked my reindeer to the floor. They said, Father Christmas, give us some money. Don't mess around with those silly toys. Beat you up, don't hide it all.
outfit. Don't give my sister a cotton toy. We don't want a jigsaw or Monopoly money. We only want the real McCoy. Father Christmas, give us some money. We'll beat you up if you make us annoyed. Father Christmas, give us some money. Don't mess around with your silly toy. But give my daddy a job, cause he needs one. He's got lots of mouths to feed. But if you've got one, I'll have a machine gun, so I can scare all the kids on the street. Father Christmas, give us some money. We've got no time for your silly toys. We'll beat you up, you don't hand it over. We want your bread, so don't make us annoyed. Give all the toys. Have a merry, merry Christmas. Have yourself a good time. But remember the kids who got nothing while you're drinking down your wine. Father Christmas, give us some money. We got no time for your silly toys. Father Christmas, please hand it over. We'll beat you up, so don't make us a